Next up, we have Fran Bridgewater. She's coming all the way from the other side of the world, and it is late there, ladies and gentlemen. I think it might be 12:30 a.m. So, Fran, you are still muted.
No, I'm not. Hello. Hi, everybody. It is very late. It is 12:30, and I've been working all day today. I've been working at a wedding.
Oh, a wedding. How many people are at the wedding?
120, so they kept us busy.
You must be very tired. So look, I really appreciate you joining us at this extreme hour, but I have been looking forward to chatting to you very much. You wear quite a few different hats, and you're making some fabulous waves over there. So I thought, look, you know, the good old Aussies, we'd love to hear what's going on. So first of all, Fran Bridgewater, director and founder of the Drinks Network brand, which is essentially a marketing agency, I guess you would say, for premium wines and luxury goods. So obviously we're focusing on the premium wine angle. Fran, why don't you take us back to the beginning and tell us about your career and how you got into the focus of wine, and we'll see how things roll from there.
Yeah, sure, no worries at all. Well, I trained as a somm, a female sommelier, in the days when it was called lunchtime wine waitress. It was in 1992. And I was very lucky. It's so funny because I work with people now who I say to them, I actually was pouring wine before you were born, which is really quite alarming. But it's
it's scary, isn't it?
It was an amazing grounding in wine. The guy basically who started it was David Alcorn, and he started Vats Wine Bar, which then became Noble Rot. Noble Rot is probably the most well-known wine bar in the whole of London. And so he started a legend. I just applied for literally a job in the Evening Standard. But what was so clever was that we used to do lunch service, and then at the end of service, whatever was left in the wine bottles, he'd sit us down and he'd say, right, let me talk you through these wines. And so that was my initial grounding in wine. And I kind of never looked back since.
Do you have some particular varietals?
Do I have what particular favourites?
Particular favourite varietals, sorry.
Yeah, I've got an absolute passion for Argentine Malbec. I've travelled a lot in the Argentine wine regions, and I would go there at the drop of a hat. It takes nothing to get me going back to Argentina again. And I think why I like Malbec so much is it's a lovely, velvety kind of very, very inky wine, particularly the Malbecs at high altitude. And I think the most beautiful thing is they've got this beautiful, sensational backdrop of snow-capped Andes Mountains. So you've got vineyards in the foreground, and then it just creeps straight up to high peaks of the Andes backing onto Chile. And it's so beautiful. The dawn there, we were there in the autumn, and riding on horseback with the autumn tint sort of changing. It takes me back there, and I think we all do this. I think this is what's clever. Water has a memory, butter apparently has a memory too, and wine definitely does. So it transports us around the world, and we all get to sort of share it. So yes, particularly Malbec blends. I'm really interested in the ones with Cabernet Franc, because I think Cabernet Franc adds real interest. I think there's a lot of incredibly good wine making coming out of Argentina, and their Viogniers as well are stunning, particularly from up north, sort of Café Arte kind of area.
You're really speaking my language, of which I understand you are multilingual. But Malbecs, I love. Viognier's got to be one of my absolute favourites. Actually, was speaking to us, Steve Smith and MW from New Zealand earlier, and a lot about Alvarino and all of these varietals. They're just so good, aren't they? So you have just recently, it's been the big London wine show. It's been going on for what, like a week or so. It seems like it's never ending. Can you tell us about that? What were the perks? What were the highs? What are you walking away with going, wow, I didn't know that?
It was really, really interesting. It's a 3-day event. It was on the Monday. I really enjoyed it because it was chilled. It wasn't that busy, so we all had a lot of chance to go around attending the seminars, the masterclasses. I think one of the areas that I was really interested in on the Monday was volcanic wines. And I'm actually starting with some trade colleagues because I've worked 22 years in the trade. I did 10 years in motorsport and telecoms in between training as a SOM and then getting my degree and then going out there. And then I came back to wine, and I've started Volcanic Wines of the World. And in fact, you guys are getting it live on air where nobody else has heard about it yet. So I'm announcing it to you first, which is a nice exclusive. We're starting a generic trade body basically because Volcanic wines are interesting in a huge number of ways, not least because from a consumer perspective, there's nothing more exciting than all the words that you associate with a volcano, in that it's explosive, unpredictable, wild, dangerous. It's got all the right words. From a wine connoisseur and adventurous explorer kind of perspective as well, I think it's really interesting because the terroir has such a large effect. And also the salinity and the fact that they're island wines quite often as well. It seems to be an area that's on the up and up. A lot of the top master somms in the UK and the Michelin starred restaurants, they're starting to put volcanic sections in their wine list. So we're seeing a shift. And there was an amazing session on the Monday at the Wine Fair all about the volcanic wines of Santorini in particular. So we had Santorini and we also had Etna. So it was great to see both. But there are an amazing number of volcanic wine regions all across the world. And the more you look, the more you see that actually a lot of the terroir within the sort of 30, 50 parallels has got volcanic base to some degree. And there's the first master sommelier of Canada, John Sabo, MS. He's got a Volcanic Wines International Conference in New York later this month. So there's that's the third year he's run that. So there's a lot going on. Volcanic is suddenly really big. It's really interesting. And I think from a trade perspective and from the press perspective, it's really nice to see wines of the same grape but with different terroirs, and with the terroirs being so varied that I think the differences are going to be really stark. I think it's going to be really interesting to do verticals, for example, as well. We've got quite a lot of plans for that, and it was inspired. We've had it sort of a plan under wraps for quite a few months now, but it was good to see the inspiration and enthusiasm because the volcanic wines session at the wine fair was absolutely packed. It was standing room.
Wow, it sounds incredible. Are you able to make the New York conference?
Not this year because it's too soon. I know John's going to try and see whether he can get a live streaming or something that we can listen to it. But next year, when we've got bigger budgets, the aim would be to fly the team over there. But also, we'd love to fly John over to us and to be a special guest. So it hopefully at both sides of the pond. And it's lovely that we can find times that Australia and England are awake at the same time.
There's not a lot of crossover. That is really fascinating. It's something I love about volcanic wines. Like many people, big fan of anything Etna. And of course, you know, Santorini. But I think it's very much that, as you say, you know, it's obviously very terroir. You can really tell when you're drinking a volcanic wine. It's a very, oh, there we go. She's drinking bubbles. I love that. I can see you. I love that. So I can see. Oh, gosh, at 12:30, I'd be doing the same. I'm drinking tea. But you really can tell. And this has been coming up quite often lately on the show, is that people love to know where their wine is coming from. They love to be able to take a sip or put their nose in the glass and they kind of guess where it is from. It's a thing, and I think volcanic wines definitely have that. So all of that, I think it's something to be watching out for, and we'll be getting a lot more information. So that's wonderful. I might have you as my foreign correspondent on the matter. Is that okay, Fran?
I will be very, very happy to be your correspondent. It'd be an honour.
Brilliant. So shall we do a bit of a talk about London's English sparkling wine? Yeah. Because that is not something that is obviously that huge over here. We don't get a huge amount of it. Give us the spiel.
Right. Well, it's an industry that has been... People have been planting vines in this country. Well, it dates to Roman times traditionally, but anyone seriously doing it commercially probably started in the 70s, 80s and 90s. All of them invariably had all of their neighbours and all of their friends going, "You're clearly mad." And all of them have actually proved them wrong, to the extent now that we've got a number of the big French champagne houses. We've got Pommery over here. We've got various of them are buying land, making their own wine. Pommery are very interesting because they're saying they're not making champagne, but they're also not making English sparkling wine. They're making their own interpretation given our terroir. But the interesting thing is geologically, we're on the Kimmeridgian Ridge, which runs like a half moon. It goes from Epernay in France. It goes all the way under the English Channel. It comes out at Kimmeridgian, where it took its name, which is literally down the road from my lovely friends at Bride Valley, Stephen Spurrier's legacy wine estate. And it actually curves all the way up to Oxfordshire. There are bits of it, there are strands of it, there are seams of it that run down to Kent as well, run all the way across to Cambridge. But what we've got, what we're seeing in this country, which is really interesting, is that we've actually got the climate that Champagne had 10 to 20 years ago. This is actually a result of global warming. So it's not a good reason for why it's happened. But what it's meaning is that where Bordeaux is suffering at the moment with long, long, very, very hot summers, and they're finding the phenolic ripeness is too fast, they're not getting the complexity of flavors, and they're getting too jammy, they're getting too much baked fruit. That's also happening in Champagne. They're losing the acidity too fast. Whereas in this country, we've got the beautiful balance. And about every 4 years in England, we have a stellar harvest. So our really, really good harvest was 2018. That was the year that everybody made more than they'd ever done before, of more quality than they'd ever done. It tends to go in 4 years. So 2022, what we're seeing of the 2022 is good. It's less. The yields were lower. But overall, what's interesting is English sparkling wine is now boxing at exactly the same level as champagne. And a bit like Stephen Spurrier when he did his Judgment of Paris in 1976, if you do blind tasting of English sparkling wine, and a number of our winemakers are actually French, or they're French trained, or they've trained in New Zealand, they've trained in Australia, they've trained all across the world. So we've got sort of totally global, really, really capable winemakers. We've got amazing growing conditions. We've got amazing terroir. And for those that had the foresight to plant in the 70s, 80s and 90s, they've got lovely, lovely long roots that are extending all the way down. We've got a whole load of chalk, which absorbs like a sponge, which is wonderful. So it lets too much water drain through, but it holds little pockets really nicely. So I think what's really interesting is we're going head to head against champagnes. Everyone can know that it's English wine versus champagnes, but it's a blind tasting and the English sparkling wine is winning. But also the other thing that I don't know whether it's reached Australia yet, our still wines now are actually doing really, really well too. We've got various pockets in the country where they're growing a really, really ripe Pinot Noir. They're also doing Pinot Precoce, which ripens earlier. So there are some very, very good still Pinot Noirs coming out. They're amazing Chardonnays, really, really mineral driven, and people are thinking they taste like Chablis, which particularly if we're using Burgundy clones, a lot of the vineyards are planted with Burgundy clones on both the red and the white, which is interesting as well. So it's big, go for it.
No, I'm just like, it's actually quite enormous. And first of all, it seems like climate change is a bit of a theme running through the show. But I've got so many questions. And one being that, you know, once upon a time, not that long ago, the high-end restaurants in London, in England, I guess especially London, they were filled with top, you know, top Burgundies, with the top French wines. At very hefty prices. And then I'm assuming now that they are being replaced with, especially now because the table wines, especially Pinot Noirs, Chardonnays, et cetera. And if you're doing these beautiful Chablis styles, they will be replacing. So can you talk to us a little bit about that? I mean, that's quite a movement in itself, and that relationship that you have with France.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's an interesting relationship that we have because it's surprising the French again and again, and they're giving us huge credibility. I think a number of years ago, there were state dinners that were having wines that weren't English, and people started to lobby them and said, we've actually got a really good, we've got more than a fledgling industry now. We have over 850 vineyards across the UK. We have 250 of those plus, it's going up by the day, have full working wineries. A lot of them have state-of-the-art wineries, which is really interesting. So in terms of the top-end restaurants, more and more, the question you can genuinely ask is, what do you have in the English section? What have you got? And also state dinners, the Queen, the late Queen, bless her, the King, all the embassy events now, embassy events across the world as well are containing at least an element of English sparkling wine or English still wine. English still wine is very much the second cousin at the moment. Yes. So it's coming in because sparkling wine has rocked ahead, but we still haven't got a word for it that actually holds it really neatly, like the word carver, for example.
Yes, in Spain. Yes, I love a good English, carver.
Yeah, English sparkling wine, they rolls on and on and on. And our queen, in fact, our present queen consort, she's said many times, can we not all come up with a word? And we do need to come up with a word. And there was a guy called Christopher Merritt, who arguably started Méthode Champenoise 50 years in advance of Dom Pérignon. And so they, that particular vineyard, Ridgeview, they wanted us to call it Merritt. But I don't think merit is good enough. If we think in exams, when children get a merit, they want a distinction. It's got a murky mud. It's got all the wrong kind of sounds for the word to actually catch on. But they're going the right way. They are going the right way. But again, you see carver, you mentioned carver being lovely. Carver is double fermentation and all the rest of it. But what it's got is it's got the reputation price-wise that it sits in with Prosecco. So it's got start.
So affordable.
It's got pigeonholed, which it is. It's the logical choice for if you want that price point. And this is the problem, I think, with English sparkling wine is that our price point is very high, because a little bit like the steep Moselle Valley, a lot of this land is quite inaccessible. And so everything is done by hand. The harvesting is done by hand. And the more that you put manual, every time you put manual labor instead of machine, the more it puts the costs up. Everybody's pretty tiny. There are a lot of vineyards that are very, very tiny. There are a number of 6-acre sites. There are a load that are very, very much bigger and that are planting and doubling and tripling their size. But still, I can't remember. I heard a wonderful statistic. I'll look it up for you and I'll send it to you. But I think something like the whole area that we've got planted under vine is only equivalent to Chablis. I think it's something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So in terms of land mass, we've not got enough coverage yet. But we're all planting wherever we can. I'm talking to my villagers because we've got a lovely little slope here that would do perfectly south facing. it's doing all the right things, and I'd love nothing better than to be helping tend a village vineyard. I think it would be really lovely. So yeah, I think it's a very exciting industry. But tell me, in Australia, what brands have you got that you can actually access of English sparkling wine? Have you got Hattingley over there?
Gosh, what do we have? I'm going to have a little
Chapel
bit of a look. Yes, we do have Chapel Down. I think one of the this is, I guess, rather topical. It's the issue of importing and tax, the expense of getting the wines over here. I mean, yes, we, you know, French champagne does very well in Australia. Funnily enough, very much so in Queensland, but. But you're still paying a lot more than a very good, say, Tasmanian sparkling. And I was going to ask you about the price point of, because obviously it is quite expensive, and it basically is the same as champagne. So how it is that you're going to address that, getting it into other countries with the tax sort of issues. But
it's a huge problem, Julian. Massive. Wine GB and the WSTA are working tirelessly on trying to get the various tariff barriers and things pulled down, lowered, lessened, subsidies put in place. Tax breaks would be really useful. They'd be really helpful. I think in terms of the UK market for any wines at all, at the lower end, at the entry level end, you've got about 70% of it's tax, packaging and all the rest of it. And then the 30% of the price is actually to do with the liquid inside. As you go up the price points up to £15, it starts to break better. It's not breaking even, yeah, but it's better. And our English sparkling wines on average are £25 to £30. And on average, our still wines are 12 to 18, I suppose. And so, yeah, you're right that, again, it is a real consumer. It's a case of understanding, wanting to buy local and support local, versus the credit crunch, the cost of living crisis that everybody's feeling across the world. And given the dreaded word Brexit, it's given us so much, so much more paperwork to do with every single country. So it's just, I think a lot of things are in the way at the moment, and I know that there are a number of English producers, the bigger ones, that are very, yes, very keen in, to get into. They're getting into Northern Europe quite a lot, so Norway and Sweden, but also they're keen to get across to China, across to India. India's got a very, very big consumer base. I was at Women in Wine Expo a couple of weeks ago, and the last panel session was, is India the next best big thing? And it's, yes, it probably is the very next big thing entirely, because the population, the interest levels are huge. But also America is a major target market and Australia is a major target market. But you guys have got a brilliant domestic production as well. So it becomes increasingly, it's getting to a bigger and bigger wall of wine in supermarkets for consumers. It's nice that it's varied. I mean, in this country, we have all country regions represented. And I think that's one way that we're very privileged to be based in the UK, in that anybody that's studying for any of their wine exams, pulling the right strings and talking to the right people, you can generally get hold of any wine in the world probably tomorrow. And yes, I think that's really unusual, because everywhere else really struggles. We can almost access everything. Our merchants are brilliant. The distribution channels are great for getting it into this country. But going back to your question, for getting it out and getting it to places like Australia, it's hard. It's not a well-trodden path yet. I think if people collaborate, it would be really good. I think if people could share pallets, share shipments, that's a really good idea. Yes. And it's sustainable as well. It makes more sense and you get more economies of scale. So I guess in a number of ways it could work. But yeah, it's a challenge for sure.
It's a definite challenge. And look, I'm just thinking of the sparkling, the English sparklings that I do know. There's the NYE Timber. That's one that's probably a bit more accessible. Hamel Valley.
Yeah. Hamel Valley is wonderful. Yeah, Bob and Sam Lindo's father and son. Team in they've got the Camel Valley Trail is a bicycle trail, so there's a lot of English vineyards that are very much linked with tourism. There are two strands that we're seeing people going down the tourism route or down the foodie route,
and I think Hambledon is definitely the other one, but I'm sure there are a few more, but it still really is not, it's not a big huge thing, and you're not finding them in every liquor store. That's definitely not the case yet. But look, you know, a lot of the obstacles that you and challenges that you've just brought up, at some point, you know, hopefully they will be dealt with. But otherwise, at least we can now, at least we're back to traveling again. So we can actually, I'm going to be in France myself in August, September. So I'll maybe in France I'll be able to pick one up.
Well, you need to let me know. I can drive to you. It takes 8 hours. So it's not far. It's not far.
Oh, Fran, 8 hours, if you would do that, then absolutely.
8 hours to get to Bordeaux wouldn't be a problem. You let me know.
And I will end up being in Bordeaux. So, look, Fran, this has been such an eye-opener. Your knowledge on the topic is incredible, and obviously your passion comes through very much. But really fascinating, both the volcanic wines and the English sparkling and the English table wines. And it's just these watch this space kind of style. So look, thank you so much for joining us. And you must be exhausted. You look amazing, by the way.
But I feel shouted. My voice is going to be really husky tomorrow. It'll be great. I won't then shout at the children at all.
Oh, there we go. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us. It has been wonderful, and we will definitely keep in touch. I'm really glad that we've made this work. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you in August and September.
Yeah, me too. Bye.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.